Daily news and analysis. We keep you informed and inspired.
This is World Today.
Welcome to World Today, a news program with a different perspective. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. In this edition of the show, we'll take a look at the trilateral summit between the United States, Japan, and the Philippines, and its broader implications for the Asia-Pacific region. U.S. President Joe Biden, Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, and Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. held a joint meeting at the White House on Thursday. A wide range of agreements to enhance security and economic ties were later unveiled by the three governments, including joint patrols in the South China Sea, research and investment collaboration on AI, and more. Pointing fingers at China, a joint statement by the three leaders said they aim to advance the vision of a free and open Indo-Pacific. The Chinese Foreign Ministry responded by saying U.S. accusations on China's position in the South China Sea are baseless, calling them attacks that merely malign China. How will the summit impact security in Asia? How do regional countries feel about the increasing militarization of their neighborhood? For these questions and more, I'm joined by Dr. Zhao Hai, Director of International Political Studies at the National Institute for Global Strategy, Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. Thank you, Dr. Zhao, for talking to us again.
Thank you for having me.
We also have Dr. Clifford Kirikov, Washington-based author and former senior professional staff member of the U.S. Senate Committee on Foreign Relations. Dr. Kirikov, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Also, we have Dr. Alan Chong, Senior Fellow at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies, Nanyang Technological University in Singapore. Welcome to you too, Dr. Chong.
Thank you for having me too.
Now, let's begin by taking a look at some of the details in security that's been announced by the leaders of these three countries. Here, I quote from a joint vision statement coming out of the trilateral summit, quote unquote, "The United States look forward to welcoming Philippine and Japan Coast Guard members onto a U.S. Coast Guard vessel during a patrol in the Indo-Pacific this year. Within the next year, our Coast Guards also plan to conduct an at-sea trilateral exercise and other maritime activities in the Indo-Pacific to improve interoperability and advance maritime security and safety." Maybe let me start with Dr. Chong, please. How big a step is this for these three countries?
I think it's the natural extension of ongoing trends of collision, diplomatic and potentially military collision between the three countries in relation to China's actions. So I'm not too surprised, but I see that there is hope that this will not escalate too far, because if you look at the nature of the measures announced in this vision statement, they stop short of all-out militarization and confrontation towards China. The idea of talking up Coast Guards suggests that this is a very limited response to what they perceive as China's very militant actions in the South China Sea. So I think there is a sense here that there is a reluctance to go all the way towards full-scale escalation. And I like to also draw attention to the rest of the vision statement, which talks about development under the umbrella of the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. That,
indeed,
I think, also shows that the trilateral summit is also about development, not just about trying to confront China.
That's very true. In the later half of the show, we'll certainly talk about what's been mentioned in the statement about the economic and trade side of the collaboration between these three countries. But
yes.
Dr. Kirikov, How big a commitment is the U.S. putting into this joint statement and this trilateral meeting, in your observation?
Well, I think it's a very significant event. It marks, I think, a new stage in U.S. policy toward the region. As you know, I'm a critic of present-day U.S. foreign policy and its militarization of the Pacific Basin. But I think we need to pay close attention to the follow-up from this, which is, in my view, a historic step in terms of particularly the U.S.-Japan relationship. I think it's elevating that to a new level. And, of course, the Philippines is an ancillary partner, but the critical dimension here is the elevation of the U.S.-Japan relationship, which actually has been in the works, you know, since really the early 2000s, step by step. So I think that's, from my standpoint, I'm watching the U.S.-Japan dimension and the implications for the further militarization of the Pacific. I believe in a Pacific Basin should be a zone of peace.
Well, before we delve into the specifics that's coming out of the bilateral between Joe Biden and Fumio Kishida, let me go to Dr. Zhao for what Dr. Chung earlier said about, you know, these measures announced by the three governments were in reaction to China's militant action in the South China Sea. Now, Dr. Zhao, how would you respond to that?
Well, I think China is defending its own sovereignty and territorial integrity. It's hardly militant. Well, if necessary, of course, China would use the force to prevent illegal occupation of Chinese lands. I know that this is a disputed issue, and the United States is using this issue to militarize and to reinforce the alliance between the United States and Japan and the Philippines. But I think this is the event of mutual escalation. It's not like that China is conducting unilateral action. And I think everybody knows what happened after Marcos, president of the Philippines, took power, and he started to get closer to the United States and actually turning against the agreement during the Duterte presidency with China. And that started the whole event, leading to a very tense relations between the two countries. And I want to go back to the joint vision of the three countries in terms of Coast Guard, because this started a year ago. The first trilateral Coast Guard exercise actually happened last June. And after that, the three countries are planning for this interoperability and you know, upgrading their Coast Guard cooperation. And the, and actually, Japan promised over $500 million U.S. dollars aid to Philippines and decided to sell Philippines five additional Coast Guard ships to upgrade Philippines' ability. And later on, they are planning for a trilateral maritime dialogue to coordinate their action. So I think this is an upgrade, a steady upgrade of their sort of three-country cooperation on maritime issues. And this is not the end. I think I agree. This this new development, this joint vision and statement is unprecedented and historical. I think there will be further steps taken. And this is, from China's perspective, very dangerous and very provocative. I think China foreign ministry has responded in a very strong tone, saying that the second Thomas Shore, China's Renai Jiao, will be defended. And it is absolutely illegal for the Philippine ships continually sitting on that rock for over 20 years. And I think China's reaction so far is absolutely justified.
Well, also earlier in the news, we know that the Chinese Foreign Ministry had summoned officials in the Japanese embassy in Beijing for a talk over this trilateral summit. But going back to what Dr. Kirikov has already started to talk about, you know, the details of the upgrading of a military alliance between the United States and Japan. This has been much in the news in the past few days. So the details include changing the U.S. military force structure in Japan and working more closely with a new joint Japanese command, and also looking for ways to co-produce weapons and tap into Japan's industrial strengths. Dr. Chung, how significant are these upgrading measures? And is Japan moving, trying to find space to move away from its pacifist tradition and constitution?
Well, you can look at it that way. Mm. If you start comparing, you know, percentages in percentages and qualitative increases in Japan's defense budget. But you see, that is just a superficial reading. I would say that Japan is actually caught in a difficult position because you have to realize that Fumio Kishida's predecessor, Shinzo Abe, tried, right, to strike a more accommodative position towards Beijing. He even visited and was seen, shaking hands and forging a more productive relationship with President Xi, while he was in office. And then, you know, you have this series of incidents in the South China Sea. And then, this started under Trump and it got worse under Biden. This idea that China is seen as a threat to U.S. high technology superiority in chips, in AI, various high technology fields. So Japan is, I think, trying to enlarge its space in between, but it looks like the space with China is closing. All right, it hasn't completely closed, but it's closing. So they're trying to head towards the United States in terms of maximizing Japanese economic competitiveness. And, you know, sometimes you have to understand, Japan has had this long-standing relationship with the United States since the end of World War II. And, you know, how else do you expect Japan to react when the United States says, we have this thing called the Chips and Science Act? And number two, we're trying to encourage, all right, a more bifurcated world of information technology production and supply and management and so on. So Japan has to hedge by going towards the United States in terms of investing more in terms of what the United States needs in terms of silicon chip productions and things like that. And, you have the rest of Southeast Asia, which has to, again, unfortunately, have to choose sides. And if I may draw attention to places in ASEAN like Singapore, Malaysia, Vietnam, we are trying not to because we still welcome China's information technology investments. At the same time, you know, we need continuing U.S. investment in other areas, including chips. And if you look at it carefully, I think this whole confrontation over microchip production is good and counterproductive for everybody in the long term. And I note that the U.S. National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, has used this analogy of a small yard with a high fence to describe how Washington is not actually going to ban, all right, Chinese-made information technology products across the board. But again, you see, I'm sure my fellow guests will have their differing views about this. So I'm just striking a middle position here. Thank you.
Okay. All right. We'll try to present, you know, all the views on the table for our listeners. But Dr. Kirikov, how do you view this position of Japan between United States and China that's being described by Dr. Chung? Because for one thing, Japan is not even a claimant in the South China Sea dispute. And for another thing, it's Japan's high-tech industry, which is, you know, respected around the world, being taken hostage by the U.S. strategy of containing China?
I agree that the policy of the United States is the containment policy, which is the old Cold War policy for, you know, since World War II, actually. So we're not seeing anything new here in terms of the overall U.S. Cold War policy. We've just seen in recent years an upgrade of the Cold War containment policy of the Eurasian landmass of which China is part. The U.S.-Japan relationship has had its ups and downs over the centuries. We had fairly good relations from the 1850s down to, maybe the 1920s when Japanese militarism took over the country. So in terms of U.S.-Japan relations, in the past, we have had very cordial relations with them. And then, of course, we had the World War II experience. And since then, we've had the U.S.-Japan treaty alliance. And the United States has wanted to use Japan as a counterweight to China, or for leverage against China, just like India, for example. And that was the whole concept of this pivot to Asia under Obama, the idea that the U.S., Australia, Japan, India would serve as a containment strategy against the so-called rise of China. But actually, Asia's rising. It's not just China that's rising. So I think that the Japanese have some hard choices to make here. In the World War I era, they chose to be with the Allies. In the World War II era, they chose to be with the Axis powers. Now, as Dr. Chong has pointed out, they're kind of stuck in the middle. And internally, I think in Japan, there's strong public opinion for a less bellicose and a more peaceful policy and against changing the constitution, etc.
Dr. Zhao Hai, so earlier Dr. Chong mentioned about the different or the policy changes in the Japanese government in Japan. First of all, do you agree that the space for being friendly with China in terms of Japan's foreign policy, has the space been narrowed and has the space closed? And second of all, if yes, then who started this process?
Well, I think it definitely is not closed. And China is still also trying to maintain a good relations with Japan. And I think that's in the future, if we want to have peace in East Asia, in the whole Asia-Pacific area, China and Japan needs to learn to how to coexist and have mutually beneficial relations with each other. So in that respect, and I also agree that Japan domestically, a very strong lobby for peace and to maintain a peace constitution. However, at this point, I also agree with Dr. Chong that to a certain extent, Japan's foreign policy has been hijacked by the United States' foreign policy towards China. However, I think from this particular summit and also reading their statement, from China's perspective, objectively, this is a very threatening document because there's a lot of items related to not defensive but offensive measures that could have been taken and will be taken in the following years, particularly the cooperation in intelligence gathering, in military increased military cooperation in terms of upgrading its joint command and control system, and also particularly in terms of weapon production and transfer, because Japan has already increased its military expenditure and also decided to break the previous principle of defense equipment transfer and guidelines. So that means that Japan in the future could produce more military equipment, weapons, ammunition to provide to the United States and also for itself. So from China's perspective, that's not defensive. We're not objecting to Japan and the United States developing bilateral relationship, even defense relationship. However, for Japan to acquire Tomahawk land attack missile and for Japan to develop unmanned aerial systems and AI system that could be used militarily, it's very, very provocative. Again, I think this is a very significant upgrade of bilateral security relationship between the two countries. And in that statement, it's particularly pointing at China. So that means this bilateral relationship is harming the third party, which is China. So I think that for China, it's legitimate to have a deep concern of the future development.
Well, what you said actually reminds me of what U.S. officials said during a background briefing on Kishida's visit on April the 9th. White House officials said, here I quote, in the last 60 years, you would define this relationship between the United States and Japan, since it got formalized in 1960, as one of alliance protection. I think this state visit kind of ends that era and defines the next period of time, this alliance projection from alliance protection. And then these officials went on to explain that the U.S. should widen the definition of what deterrence looks like, adding that the trilateral meeting between U.S., Japan, and Philippines is about credible deterrence too. Dr. Chung, how do you understand this transition from alliance protection to alliance projection mentioned by these officials? And what does it mean for Asia security?
I think it's okay. Unfortunately, you know, both my fellow speakers have alluded to this revival of the Cold War, and it looks increasingly like that. And you have to understand that it's not as if the United States has never had special defense relations with both Manila and Tokyo. Mm. They've had this since the end of World War II. All right, Japan is because of, you know, the U.S. occupation at the end of World War II, and then as part and parcel of the then envisioned neutralization and demilitarization of Japan, the United States offered Tokyo this special mutual defense treaty to basically tell Japan, never remilitarize because I will be your protector, and so on. And of course, the Philippines was facing at the point of independence, a long-running communist insurgency that has not completely died out, all right? You know, there's still pockets of this kind of insurgency in the Philippines, and they had this relationship. So one view is that the two countries, Japan and the Philippines, have basically switched on a treaty that has been more or less in the background. They've switched it on, and that's why you see this signature that looks offensive to China. All right, so if you look at it that way, it's alarming. But I wouldn't go so far as to say, oh, you know, we're heading straight towards, you know, some kind of armed confrontation in the South China Sea or in the East China Sea and so on. Because I think Asian states have got a very sturdy framework of diplomatic arenas, right? Something which the Middle East does not have, something that Eastern Europe does not have. And we are, I think, fortunate to be in this position where we're talking about confrontation without actually being in a full-scale one, like in Russia, Ukraine, like in the Middle East. All right? We have diplomatic arenas to prevent this rush towards war. Thank you.
Okay. Could you elaborate a little more about this political arena in among Asian states?
Go back to the mission statement. You notice that they were careful, the three countries were careful. They acknowledged ASEAN centrality. Okay, I'm not saying this because I'm from ASEAN, but ASEAN centrality is important.
Right.
Because ASEAN is serving as a convenient meeting point without causing any great power to lose face. So Japan can happen to be in an ASEAN organized meeting to meet with China. Same with the United States, they can happen to be there to meet China, and the same thing with India versus India meeting China, and so on. So in this sense, ASEAN centrality actually is a phrase that means the United States is still open to resolving differences, or at least managing differences with China, by meeting on the sidelines of these ASEAN organized frameworks. And I'm sure your listeners will be familiar with forums like the ASEAN Regional Forum, the East Asia Summit. APEC is not strictly linked to ASEAN, but again, ASEAN works behind the scenes to keep APEC going and so on. And of course, there's the ASEAN Defense Ministers meeting. Plus, right. Do not forget that that is emerging as a premier security forum across East Asia, with even India expressing interest
to join. Okay, we are going to a short break, but when we come back, I want to get more of our guest's view on this U.S. mention of alliance protection to alliance projection. You're listening to World Today. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, as one of CGTN Radio's most popular programs, World Today provides listeners with a strong mix of international news and business. It delivers in-depth analysis of current affairs and one-on-one interviews, bringing you the stories behind the news, not just what's happening, but why.
Welcome back to the show. We are having a panel discussion on the trilateral summit between the United States, Japan, and the Philippines. We have with us Dr. Zhao Hai, Director of International Political Studies at the National Institute for Global Strategy, Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, Dr. Clifford Kirikoff, Washington-based author and former senior professional staff member of the U.S. Senate Committee on Foreign Relations. Also, we have Dr. Alan Chong, senior fellow at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies, Nanyang Technological University in Singapore. Now, going back to our earlier discussion on this alliance protection to alliance projection. Now, Dr. Kirikoff, you worked in U.S. Senate for Foreign Relations. I mean, how should we understand this transition?
Well, it's a new phrase, but essentially when we talk about traditionally in the United States security community, when we talk about projection, we mean force projection, that is military projection, force projection, which is a more aggressive, forward-looking, leaning approach than a deterrent, a more relaxed deterrence. So I see this as a ratcheting up of the Cold War containment strategy, which, if we go back to, for example, 2001, I was at a series of briefings at the State Department with the new administration of George W. Bush. And I was talking with then Deputy Secretary of State Dick Armitage, and we were discussing India and China and the new administration's approach. And Dick said, well, you know, we have to manage the rise of China and India, which I thought was a little interesting kind of a comment. In 2005, the United States foreign policy elite had a large series of conferences on upgrading our foreign policy for the new situation in the world, the rise of China, etc. So a new phase in the Cold War, an upgrade of U.S. Cold War strategy. I want to emphasize that many foreign analysts miss the fact that there's great continuity in U.S. foreign policy. And so you can, from administration to administration, because the elite generally has a bipartisan approach. There may be some differences here and there, but there is a broad bipartisan agreement. In this case, there's broad bipartisan, continuing bipartisan agreement on the containment of Russia and China, the Eurasian landmass, which is the Cold War mentality, definition of a Cold War mentality. So with that said, you can take a look at the Obama administration and the pivot to Asia, and they wanted 60% of U.S. military power to project into Asia. So between Obama and the following presidents, that has continued. So I would emphasize for analysts, particularly specialists, to take a look at the continuity of American foreign policy rather than thinking that this or that administration is going to change the general thrust of policy, particularly nowadays against China and in the Asia-Pacific region.
So when we reflect history, there's actually a thread that you can pull, and then all things of this containment can be all pulled out. Well, another significant thing that came out recently and also in the joint statement by defense ministers of AUKUS, the military bloc between Australia, United Kingdom, and United States. The statement was on April the 8th. It said, recognizing Japan's strength and its close bilateral defense partnerships with all three countries, we are considering cooperation with Japan on AUKUS Pillar 2. advanced capability projects. But then, during Kishida's visit in Washington, during the joint press briefing with Joe Biden, Fumio Kishida said, "We have consistently supported AUKUS, but for Japan to have a direct cooperation with AUKUS, nothing has been decided at this moment." Dr. Zhao Hai, what do AUKUS Pillar 2 advanced capabilities include, first of all? And, I mean, what are Japan? What is Japan bringing to the table?
Well, I think this is a new concept of Pillar 2, because originally this is about the three-country cooperation between UK, United States, and Australia, and the focus is actually aimed at the Taiwan issue, the Taiwan Strait. They're encouraging Australia to get involved and trying to equip Australia with nuclear-powered submarines. However, I think over the years, in the past couple of years, that they realized that if they only focus on this particular issue, there's a switch of government in Australia, there's great resistance within Australia, and there's a slow process of turning that into reality. So they need to come up with something new. And now those three countries start to developing another leg, which is technological cooperation, including supply chains, new technologies, and also mutual interoperability in terms of military preparedness. So now they're considering to add Japan into Pillar 2. And Japan, of course, we consider that a technology power, and Japan can bring to the table of its technology prowess. So in this process, I think on the one hand, Japan and the United States don't want to make this make Japan an official member of AUKUS right now. In the future, there's a possibility. However, they also wanted to bring Japan in some way. So the best way to add Japan into this alliance is to use Japan as a supplier of technology and also a partner in terms of developing industrial capability. So at this point, that is the very statement. Actually, this action alone is verifying what you've just said of developing Japan-U.S. relations from a protection to projection, which means that Japan is projecting outside of its previous parameter and becoming a more active participant in all regional security structure that set up by the United States, and also participating in global diplomatic and military and security operations with the United States. So I think in this way, the U.S. is more freely and willingly enlisting Japan's help, assisting in those areas. So that's why in that statement, the United States listed IPEF, IPEF, Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, also G7, also other international forum or mechanism as a platform for Japan to play a bigger role. So in the future, I think this alliance will manifest itself in many more security alliances or regional and global arrangements by the United States, enhancing or restoring step by step of Japan's global influence, if that matter.
So Japan's taking on more ambitions and tasks for the United States now. Going back to Dr. Kirikov, now we already had AUKUS, we had a Quad, the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue in Asia. And now we have, you know, this trilateral summit between United States, Japan, and Philippines. How many more Asian regional countries are is United States trying to recruit into this campaign? Is that what the U.S. government is trying to do?
Well, yes. the United States is actually creating what one might refer to as a co-prosperity sphere in the Asia Pacific, with the help of Japan, who has some experience in that project. So I think the United States is trying to create even more of a network or intensify the network that's already there. We have treaties with longstanding treaties, defense treaties with Japan, with the Philippines, with Australia, New Zealand, and so on. So those are longstanding treaties, and we've had the so-called hub and spoke policy out there for decades. So this basically what we're seeing now in terms of a historical overview is just an upgrade and some restructuring and some strengthening of pre-existing alliances. So bringing the Philippines in or bringing others in makes sense in terms of Washington's concept of this new co-prosperity sphere. They'll try to get Vietnam in and some others as well. So this is a diplomatic as well as a military operation and economic too. All the tools of national strategy are involved, of course. I said before, I'm a critic of this policy. I think we should have a U.S.-Japan-China trilateral relationship that's positive. The three countries should have a positive relationship that could be good for the Asia-Pacific and the world in general. But the United States is coming, is not permitting such or not desiring such, or Washington is not desiring such a strategy of U.S., Japan, China, positive, constructive relationships, cooperation. So, unfortunately, we're faced with the securitization of the Asia-Pacific now. And it's a long term. Don't forget, AUKUS is 40 years. So the United States is trying to rope in countries, not just for the next few years, but they're trying to rope in countries for, the next X number of decades in the big project of containing China.
Well, Dr. Chung, we have been constantly mentioning, this dilemma faced by Japan of being in the middle. But Singapore is in the middle too, right? So if Singapore has always played a constructive role, between the East and the West, why cannot Japan do that too?
Japan cannot do that because it has this mutual defense treaty, the mutual security alliance with the United States. So in that sense, it is already allied. So it cannot appear to be the so-called honest broker in a diplomatic relationship. But of course, that does not mean that Japan cannot try to project itself as a peaceful soft power in the Asia-Pacific, in the Indo-Pacific, or in the world. And I disagree with Dr. Kirakov on one point. He implies that the United States has supervening hegemonic power, diplomatic or otherwise, to lead the Indo-Pacific states into some kind of alliance or some kind of coalition against China. I disagree with that. If you look at individual foreign policies and the dynamics behind those foreign policies of each of these Indo-Pacific states, it's very different. It's very complex. You cannot say the United States is the grand, leader behind it. You look at India's position on the Russia-Ukraine on various things. All right? You cannot assume that India is fully aligned with the United States. Thank you.
Well, let's talk about that, Dr. Chung, because I agree. Public opinion and also the government policy of countries within ASEAN, other than the Philippines, matter a great deal on this issue because all these countries are important players in the region. And ASEAN centrality is something that's been treasured, by all sides from all of the time. So, Dr. Chung, enlighten us on, on the current state of public opinion. Let's see. I mean, different, as you said, different countries view these things differently. But in general, how do ASEAN nations view this increasing militarization of the region?
It's a very complex picture. Most of Southeast Asia, meaning basically the entire ASEAN, would rather not choose sides. You have to understand that China is a historical neighbor. And China's development has been good for all of ASEAN. All right? There was a time when the United States seemed like the one great power, although it wasn't contiguous, meaning it did not have direct land and maritime borders with Southeast Asia. It seemed like it was the one to go to for aid projects for infrastructure. But China has developed so quickly that China is now seen as the one most readily developing these things. Now, there's a huge irony in this White House vision statement.
Mm.
In the sense that if you look carefully at Philippine infrastructure development, again, you can check this, your listeners can check this through a simple search on the internet. During the pandemic, when everything and everybody seemed to be in lockdown mode, China actually built important infrastructure in the Philippines.
Mm.
Again, I don't know whether your listeners have visited Manila, because the traffic jams are legendary, all right? But China built three bridges, all right? It's not just for symbolic purposes. They are important in alleviating traffic jams in the capital. And it was something that should have been done 30, 40 years ago.
Mm.
But China did it within, you know, the 3 years of the pandemic, which is a wonderful feat. And I'm not just singling this out as an irony in relation to the Philippines. You look at Cambodia. Who has helped Cambodia build infrastructure, condominiums, roads, bridges, and now upgrading their airport? You need Chinese capital. All right? Is the United States prepared to actually put the money into this Indo-Pacific economic framework and say, you know, I'm going to build. All right, I'm not going to look carefully at the human rights records, and I'm just going to build, because in the long run, human rights will come once you have, you know, basic infrastructure and so on. So I think this is how Southeast Asia will look at China. Yes, we have our disagreements in China over the South China Sea. So the Philippine-China frictions over the Thomas Shoal and so on. You know, it's just one instance. You look at Malaysia, you look at Vietnam, you look at even tiny Brunei, they've all got differences with China over the South China Sea. But it's all about managing this difference. That's how Southeast Asia would prefer to react to China.
Mm.
All right. And at the same time, we have not forgotten that the United States has been a long-term friend. Why do you throw away a long-term friendship? Okay. When the United States still invests in your economies, perhaps it doesn't build infrastructure like China, but the United States is a major investor.
Mm.
Okay, then that's why we are always in the middle. Thank you.
Dr. Kirikov, so considering what Dr. Chong has mentioned, you know, the amazing projects that's been built by China in Southeast Asian countries, what are the Asian people want at this moment? Is it more military ships, or is it more development projects? And what is the nature in the Asia game at the moment?
Well, first let me say that I did not mean to imply that the United States has all this power in the Pacific. As a matter of fact, I see it shifting away from power, shifting away from the United States, and the United States trying to so-called project power. So I think, Alan Chong, I wasn't trying to imply that the United States was hegemonic. In terms of the development in the Asia-Pacific, of course, countries would want a peaceful development and a peaceful Asia-Pacific so that economic development can move forward. Militarization, of course, is expensive and takes away from various types of constructive development projects. So my view would be the United States should be involved in the Asia-Pacific in a peaceful manner, and particularly through investments and exchanges of various kinds, productive investments and projects, etc. Unfortunately, the United States, the dominant group in Washington, D.C., has a different perspective. They still maintain the Cold War perspective. And unless that changes, I think the United States is in for some problems out in the Asia-Pacific, not to mention the rest of the world, as it's becoming less popular because of the Gaza situation, the Ukraine situation, and all of that.
Mm.
So if the United States tones down its bellicosity and emphasizes economic development, I think that would, and actually joins, we should have joined the Chinese effort, the so-called Belt and Road, etc., the different banking structures and all of that. So the United States should participate in a cooperative way with Asian economic development. And it'd be good for us too, of course.
Mm. Going back to Dr. Chung for a bit, recently the debate between former Singaporean ambassador to the United Nations, Kishore Makhbani, with the director of the China Center, Orville Shell at Asia Society, has brought a lot of attention in the public opinion on U.S.-China relations. And during the debate, Kishore mentioned that he thinks how the West views China is different from how the rest views China. I mean, Dr. Chung, do you agree with him on that?
Well, I can't say that I followed that debate closely, but I'm acquainted with Mr. Kishore Makhbani's wider views.
Mm.
And yes, broadly, I'm in agreement with him in the sense that I've alluded to some of this in my earlier comments, in the sense that China is a historic neighbor. And if you look at this long history that predated World War II, we've been traders with China. We've also had cultural exchanges. And if you look at the transfer of ideas from the rest of the world, from Asia, within Asia, from the Arab world, from Southeast Asia to China and vice versa. It all came, all right, through all these maritime trading relations as well as land borders. And in this sense, you have to understand that, you know, concepts like Eurasia is actually quite inaccurate. Mm-hmm. If you look at the micro picture of political geography on the ground between Southeast Asia and China, and this is why Makhbani is spot on, if you ask me, to say that China is viewed very differently.
Well, this is related to something that's very interesting, said by some White House officials again. During April 9th background briefing of the meetings between the three leaders, they said, quote unquote, in every practice that we're doing, the strategic, diplomatic, military exercises of doing multinational, is that the end result is that China's attempt to intimidate one country, make an example of that country, and intimidate others in the neighborhood flips the script, and China is the isolated and the outlier in the neighborhood. Dr. Chung, can this result of China being isolated and outlier in the neighborhood be achieved? Why or why not, in your opinion?
I don't think it is possible to reduce, you know, the perspective of many Asian states towards China to that kind of statement.
Mm.
You know, maybe if you're angry over, say, an incident, okay, and I believe the Philippine Coast Guard has experienced plenty of incidents with China in the Thomas Shoal and so on. You know, you might say this for that few days or for that whole week. You know, but if you look at the complexity of the overall relationship with China, that is an inaccurate statement.
Mm.
All right?
Mm.
From time to time, even between the best of neighbors, all right, there will be differences. And the way Southeast Asia is related to China is that we found ways to manage those differences.
Mm.
Yes, you know, we share some of the language used in the White House statement, like adherence to rules-based order, et cetera, et cetera. You know, but the difference when ASEAN says this to China is that we invite China to be part of this diplomatic communique.
Mm.
And in the language outside the official diplomatic communique, we tell China, you're welcome as an investor. You're welcome as a country that sends tourists, sends technicians, sends scientists, sends professors to us to help with various things. So you have to understand that, you know, words in the ASEAN-China relationship are not limited to what's printed in official documents.
Right.
All right? There are also languages of cooperation that are outside of this formal diplomatic documents.
Mm. Well, let me go back to Dr. Zhao Hai for a bit, because this trilateral meeting has implications on security in Asia. It also has implications on U.S.-China relations. So the U.S. and China recently have been engaging in active diplomacy on critical economic and other issues. Janet Yellen has just been in China. Now, with this trilateral meeting and the strong language, on China coming out of Washington, Dr. Zhao Hai, how do you view the possible implications of this on the bigger picture of U.S.-China relations?
Well, before I answer your question, I want to go back a little bit to Mr. Kirikov's comments just now about U.S. strategic thinking in the long term. And I think the idea of first island chain and the control of that island chain in U.S. geopolitical thinking is really, you can trace that back in a long time to 19th century. And over time, the United States has reinforced the idea. And after World War II, really built on top of that idea and tried very hard to control the first island chain. That's why Japan and Philippines is so important for the United States. And for that matter, also Taiwan. Mm. So you've seen that after the rise of China, the U.S. is really concerned that that they're going to lose the control of First Island Chain. And this very old idea is coming back alive. Mm. And that's why they're reinforcing their alliance with Japan, with Philippines, and trying to link other countries, including bringing NATO into the area and building this grand alliance against China. Mm. So overall, I think this idea is promoting the U.S. action and also the current strategic planner in the United States having this idea deeply embedded in their mind. That's why they want to pivot to Asia. They wanted to build this new alliance system in Asia. Mm. So back to China-U.S. relations, I think after recent visits of Janet Yellen, Secretary Yellen, and then later on, I think Secretary Blinken will also visit China. Mm. The very idea from Biden administration is to maintain stability of the bilateral relationship. Mm. They don't want to improve the relationship. They just want to stabilize the relationship and then do whatever they're currently doing. Small yard, high fence, suppressing China's technological development, containing China economically, militarily, and security, increase their deterrence. So I think in the short run, it's very hard to see a promising outcome from the interaction between the two sides. The best outcome we can expect is to maintain this current stability and prevent crisis and conflict from happening between the two countries.
Dr. Zhao Hai, we're running out of time. I'm sorry to interrupt. That's all the time we have for this edition of World Today. We had with us Dr. Zhao Hai, Clifford Kirikov, and Dr. Alan Chung. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Thank you for staying with us. Bye for now.